Thanks, Evan, and thanks everybody for joining today and opportunity to celebrate 100 years of the Ecological Society and tremendous progress across a wide range of important fronts. And I want to talk today about climate change and problem space and the solution space. And it's really important that we've reached a stage in this dialogue where we really can focus on solutions as much as on problems. I'm going to focus a lot on the work of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which I just want to put in perspective. As far as I know, it's a unique enterprise in science, and I think it's unique in the history of the human endeavor. The IPCC is essentially a deal between the world's governments and the scientific community, where the government said, "The scientific community, if you'll follow our rules, we'll consider your assessments to be the definitive statements, what we know, what we don't know about climate change." And the scientific community back in 1988 said, okay, we'll follow the rules. And the rules are, they're a big deal. They involve many layers of independently monitored review. They involve a requirement that the assessments be really comprehensive. And they involve a uniquely challenging but uniquely effective plenary approval process for the summaries for policymakers that assure that there's government buy-in. The nature of these summary for policymaker approval sessions is put the first sentence up on the whiteboard, and I say, is there anybody in the audience who doesn't agree that this represents a definitive statement of where we are in the scientific literature? And might say, warming the climate system is unequivocal. And there's representatives of every country in the world, and if Kuwait or Brazil or Syria says, well, we're not comfortable that that's what the literature says, we don't go on beyond that statement until every country has agreed. Incredible that this works, but it really does. And in many ways, it's an inspirational reminder that there actually are a few things that the global community can do collectively. Unfortunately, we are far along in our discussion of climate change, and this is an important anniversary in two ways. It's an important anniversary because it's the celebration of the 100th anniversary of the Ecological Society. But it's also the 50th anniversary of the first major report to the government of the United States that climate change was an important issue that we ought to be dealing with. I know the date is way too small to see at the bottom of this, but it says in November of 1965, the President's Science Advisory Council delivered a report on restoring the quality of the environment. And it was the first time that any official body had raised the issue of climate change and the importance of grappling with it. It was delivered by the Environmental Pollution Panel of this President's Science Advisory Community. The panel included David Pimentel from Cornell, shows a first indication of the level of engagement of the ecological community throughout the emergence of climate change as a critical issue. This Environmental Pollution Panel was chaired by Roger Revelle. It's really one of the key players in pulling together information about the interaction between the carbon cycle, the climate system, and environmental systems in general. Before I start into this discussion about the problem space and the solution space, I want to call out three real heroes from the Ecological Society who've done a tremendous amount in setting up the issue and in driving it, and both on the national and international stage. And these people are in the upper left, Hal Mooney. Hal Mooney, more than any other person, is responsible for the recognition that when we talk about the role of ecosystems in climate change, we're talking about ecology and not just biogeochemistry, that you need to understand ecological interactions, you need to understand what people do, what organisms do, and the way they fit together. Jane Lubchenco, especially in her role as administrator of NOAA, played a critical role in institutionalizing approaches to climate change. She was really a pioneer in the concept of climate services, which is really now the foundation of the way countries around the world are addressing, especially the problem of climate change adaptation. And Jerry Melillo in the lower right there really was, in many ways, the primary creator of the idea that that country-based assessments could play a critical role in preparing the ground for effective action on climate change. All three of these individuals were presidents of the Ecological Society, and I know a lot of the ideas that they brought together were inspired by their interactions with colleagues in the society. Okay, I want to turn now to the broad problem of addressing climate change, and I want to pose a different framing than many of you are used to. And the framing is that if we're going to be effective in addressing climate change, we need to understand it as a problem in understanding, managing, and reducing risks. It's really quite different than the idea that we want to solve a scientific problem and then implement the solution. There are many aspects of the problem that we're never going to understand completely, whether chaotic components of the climate system or where the interactive responses of human societies and ecosystems in the climate are just too complicated to think that we're going to know what is going to happen in detail. And so we need to approach the issue as a problem in managing risk. I want to spend just a couple minutes explaining the concept of risk and use that as a foundation for explaining how we can move forward. I'm going to play a short video here that highlights some of the key issues that you need to understand.
Climate change poses risks for people, ecosystems, and economies. Think of risk as probability times consequences. Some risks are high because the outcome has a high probability of occurring. Other risks are high because the consequences are very severe, even if the probability is low. Risk results from the interaction of hazards, exposure, and vulnerability. Let's take a look at what these terms mean. A hazard is an event or trend, like a heat wave, wildfire, or coastal flood. Exposure is people, ecosystems, or assets at risk. Finally, vulnerability is susceptibility to harm or limited ability to cope and adapt.
Why focus on risk? There are at least five reasons. The first is that we know that we're not prepared for many of the climate-related events we experience now. And one of the features of conceptualizing this as a problem in managing risk is it connects our current experience with climate-related events with the things we'll experience in the future. A second advantage of thinking about climate as a challenge in managing risk is that it points us toward the role of extremes. We know that families don't lose their farm because of an average temperature, that nobody's property is lost because of average sea level rise, at least that we've experienced so far. But in extremes is where things break, and we know in the future that'll continue to be the case. Focus on extremes. A third motivation for thinking about climate change as a challenge in managing risks is that we want to make sure that we look at the full range of possible outcomes. Big problem in climate science to date is that there's been a focus on most likely outcomes. We've learned a tremendous amount from that, but those are probably not the outcomes of greatest concern. We want to make sure that we're looking at the low probability, high consequence outcomes just as carefully as we're looking at the most probable outcomes. Fourth is actually a positive one, and it's one where we'll move through the talk, and it has to do with the fact that we already have a wide range of sophisticated tools for managing risk. In many firms, the risk management officer is the second most highly paid employee. And governments think hard about managing risk when they're doing infrastructure, when they're planning national security. Families think about risk when they decide how many airbags in a car or whether you should have anti-lock brakes. So we have a lot of tools, and those tools can be deployed just as effectively in addressing climate change as they can in all of the other avenues that they're deployed now. And then finally, an important motivation for thinking of climate change as a challenge in managing risks is that we know that climate change isn't a brand new thing. Climate change basically adds new dimensions, new complexities to pre-existing problems, issues of human health, issues of water availability, issues of flood risk, issues of storm surge, issues of species conservation. All those get new dimensions, new complexities as a consequence of climate change. I appreciate the really great turnout. There are a whole bunch of seats that are available in the front, and I wouldn't be offended if people wanted to come to the front and take some of those seats. So let's talk just, I'll give people a minute to come to the front, particularly because the screen's so small. The ideas are not as small as the screen. I still see about 20 seats that are open in the front if anybody else is ambitious enough to walk up the aisle. Okay, let's talk a little bit more about the dimensions of risk and the way that different components contribute to the emergence of risk of climate change.
Risk of climate change impacts emerge from the interaction of hazards, exposure, and vulnerability. The frequency and intensity of hazards are affected by both natural variability and anthropogenic climate change. Now, natural variability is our climate's natural tendency to vary from day to day or year to year. Anthropogenic climate change is different. People are changing the climate, especially through the emissions of heat-trapping gases. This human-caused climate change is warming the air and the oceans, melting snow and ice, and changing the occurrence of extreme events like heat waves and heavy rain. People are important in determining the risks of climate change. This is because society and its pathways also influence risk. These socioeconomic processes include changes in people's livelihoods, economies, and well-being over time, actions to reduce the amount of climate change that occurs and to prepare for impacts that can't be avoided, and the policies and operations of governments. Impacts can affect both society and the climate.
Okay, I want to think about this as a map of the problem space. Critical difference from what you've probably seen before is that this map has, beyond the climate hazards, also the concepts of vulnerability and exposure. For many of the scientists in the disaster risk reduction community, disasters are really a social construct, and it doesn't really matter what the hazards are. But when you look at the intersection between climate change and disaster risk, it's really clear that you need to consider the dynamic hazard environment as well as vulnerability and exposure. So you can think about risk of impacts as really emerging from this overlap. And you can also think about the opportunities for addressing the problem with emissions reductions as emerging from the same set of factors. Okay, let's back up. I want to talk about the details of the problem space and then transition to the solution space. Picture of warming over the last century. Almost every place is warmed, a little less than 1°C now. One of the really interesting features, and I know the screen's probably too small to see it, but there's really only one place in all of the world's land masses where there's sufficient data to ask whether or not we've seen warming, but it really hasn't been significant. It's right here. And it's, I think there's a message in the fact that our nation's capital is essentially the only place where there hasn't been statistically clear indication of climate change. But every place else, it's been true. There's some white spots on that map, and those are places that are white because the historical record simply doesn't extend far enough back for us to have a clear indication of the warming that, of century-scale warming. Here's where the heat's gone. You know, there's been a tremendous amount of discussion in the last several years about whether there's been a pause or a hiatus in warming. And one of the things that this graph makes clear is that in terms of the extra heat in the Earth system, there was never any indication of a hiatus. The amount of heat in the oceans has been increasing, and potentially even at a more rapid rate in the last couple of decades. And, well, you can't see it, and in this one you're actually not supposed to see it. There's a tiny sliver across the bottom of this figure. It's a kind of a maroon color, and it's the amount of heat in the atmosphere. And it's a tiny sliver because over the past several decades, the fraction of the extra heat in the Earth system that stayed in the atmosphere, it's only been a couple of percent. And one of the things that that small number illustrates is how much leverage heat uptake by the oceans has on the extent to which you see or don't see warming. But there also are a number of really compelling new studies out demonstrating that there really hasn't been a pause in warming at all. Studies that received a punctuation mark by the confirmation that 2014 was the warmest year in the observational record. But the heating of the Earth system has continued at an accelerating pace over the last several decades. And we've seen evidence of this around the Earth system. Obviously, we've seen it in the atmosphere, land, and ocean temperatures. We've seen it in changes in important kinds of extreme events, especially heavy precipitation and heat wave events. Lots of changes in the water cycle, especially with earlier onset of runoff. Lots of changes in sea ice, glaciers, and ice sheets. A dramatic loss of ice volume from the major ice sheets, continental ice sheets, as well as land glaciers. And of course, profoundly clear increase in global sea level that's about 20 centimeters over the last century. And based on many, many lines of evidence, it's clear that human influence on the climate system is clear. And one of the things that's dramatic about where we are now that you couldn't really say 5 years ago is that the question of climate change is no longer a hypothetical. Climate's clearly changing, humans are clearly to blame, and we're clearly seeing impacts. What do these impacts look like? Well, let's step back first and talk about the emissions patterns. It's been clear. Arrhenius talked about it in 1896, that we had an issue with coal combustion potentially leading to increasing atmospheric CO2 and increases in global temperature. And it's been clear that the approach to dealing with that was finding a way to transition the energy system off of fossil-based fuels. But we haven't had much success in doing that, at least until very recently, and I'll talk about that in a minute. This is a pattern of global emissions of the major heat-trapping gases from 1970 to 2010, and it illustrates two important things I want to mention. The first is that we have a problem that's basically two-thirds an industry problem and about one-third a land use agriculture problem. So CO2 from land use, methane, nitrous oxide are all more associated with land use and agriculture than they are with industry. And one of the things that's especially challenging as the world community looks at a new climate agreement in Paris in December of this year is that the technologies, the policies for addressing the industrial part of the problem are in many ways a lot simpler than the policies for addressing at least the bulk of the land problem. We have some great opportunities in land, and I'll talk about those in a little bit. But many of the biggest challenges are there as well. A second important feature of this figure is that as global attention has focused on the importance of the climate problem, the rate of growth of emissions has actually increased. And you can see that from 1970 to 2000, the growth rate was a little over 1% per year. From 2000 to 2010, it was a little over 2% per year. Now, while that represents a big challenge, 2014 was striking. 2014 was the first year when we had a combination of reasonably robust economic growth worldwide and no increase in emissions from the year prior. In the end, we'll get back to the question of whether this indicates that we may be in some important ways reaching a turning point. What's responsible for this growth in emissions? A common way to do this is to use the Kaya identity so that we can divide the emissions growth into population, wealth, the energy intensity of wealth creation, and the carbon intensity of energy generation. And what you can see is that the positive contributors to emissions growth have been human population growth and increase in wealth. That's been the biggest contributor. And there's been a consistent negative input from the amount of energy required to produce a unit of GDP. One thing that's frustrating about this figure is that we had been, over several decades, making several progress in the amount of carbon that was required to produce a unit of energy. But in the period from 2000 to 2010, that reversed. so that we were essentially recarbonizing the energy system. In many ways, there was a renaissance of coal from 2000 to 2010. The emergence of fracking has in many ways pushed that down, and the most recent data indicate that that's reversed, but it's a troubling feature of this decadal scale graph. Okay, so where are we in terms of impacts? I'm sure speaking to the ecological community, it's not necessary to reinforce the point that the impacts of climate changes that have already occurred are widespread, consequential. We've seen impacts on every continent, the oceans. We've seen impacts from the equators to the poles and from the mountains to the oceans. This is a very different statement than we were able to make just a few years ago, and it's incredibly empowering in terms of thinking about smart policies moving forward. Here's kind of a conceptual map of the kinds of impacts on physical systems, biological systems, and human systems that have been documented around the world. This map indicates something about the role of climate change relative to other factors, and it also shows the confidence with which the assessments are made. I realize those are micro-sized for the people at the back, and here's a zoom-in on North America, and you can see that there are identified high-confidence impacts associated with changes in snow and ice, changes in the water cycle, changes in coastal flooding, changes in ecosystems, including wildfires and fisheries, and some kinds of human impacts are already beginning to emerge, especially impacts on some kinds of economic activity. Here are a couple specific examples of the kinds of impacts we've seen. I'm sure all of you know that increasing crop yields has been one of the triumphs of the human spirit over the last half century or so, where yields of the major food crops have increased 1 to 2% year on year. But now we're seeing that the climate changes that have already occurred have made it more and more difficult to increase crop yields. The climate changes that have already occurred at the global scale are acting as an anchor, making it more difficult to increase yields, especially of wheat, where the effect is about 2% per decade, and maize, where the effect is about 1% per decade. Across a wider and wider spectrum of activities, we're seeing these clear kind of indications that climate changes are already having an impact. In technical terms, the attribution detection of impacts has really reached a new level. Let's talk for just a minute about vulnerability. We know that vulnerability and exposure are widespread. In many ways, vulnerability and exposure are most challenging in areas that have low levels of income, weak governance, weak institutions, poor equality. But that's not the only place that we see dramatic evidence of vulnerability and exposure. If you think about the experience in the United States with Superstorm Sandy a couple years ago, it was clear that we weren't prepared and that vulnerability is high here. One of the most challenging topics for discussion on the international stage is figuring out how to think about vulnerability when the element that's at risk is human life, which is typically the core concern in poor areas, versus economic assets, which are typically the concern in wealthy areas. But there's no question that every place is vulnerable. Every place could be better prepared. Talk about the world of the present. And there's one other really important bright spot I want to turn to before we get into the specifics of where we're headed. And it's that adaptation specifically targeted to address climate change is no longer a hypothetical. We're seeing real investments in climate change adaptation around the world. A lot of those are at the level of planning processes, but some are real infrastructure, like this flood barrier in the Netherlands. And many more are investments in community-based adaptation where communities are coming together to think about strategies for early warning systems, coastal protection, or working together in ways that are consistent with whatever level of resources are available. This example of mangrove planting in Tuvalu. I'll just tell a little story about the trials of doing international climate assessment. We chose this as a photograph to feature in the IPCC report because it provides such a beautiful example of a goal of community-based adaptation. But immediately when we did this, the mangrove replanting organization in the Philippines said this is the worst technique of mangrove replanting they had ever seen, and we should be embarrassed for featuring this photograph, and that you really should replant mangroves in these huge, messy things where they're existing plants, and they would look chaotic. So you should view this as a stylized representation of adaptation. Lots and lots of examples of adaptation already occurring. Frustratingly, most are at the level of putting plans in place, but most U.S. cities now have some kind of climate adaptation plan in place. Many states do, and we're really seeing the emergence of a whole new component. One of the things that we'll talk about in the nature of the solution space is how we should conceptualize the relationship between investments in adaptation and mitigation. So where are we headed? I think the clearest way to talk about where we're headed with climate change is that the more it warms, the more we face a risk of impacts that are severe, pervasive, and in many cases, irreversible. Let's talk about some of the details. The top figure, you can see the record of the warming to date, and then a contrast between two possible worlds. The red plume at the top is a world of continued high emissions. It's a world that, by the best estimates, would end us up at the end of this century at something like 4, a little more above pre-industrial. The bottom, the blue plume, is a world of ambitious mitigation. It's a little hard to say at this point how ambitious we might be able to be successfully, but you can see that that's a world that ends the century at something like 2C above pre-industrial, maybe a little better, and there's a big debate about that now. And the bottom are maps of warming between now and the end of the century for this world of ambitious mitigation on the left-hand side and the world of continued high emissions on the right-hand side. Going back to the top figure, I want to talk about two time slices. Now, above the arrow, we're in what you might think of as an era of climate responsibility. It's an era where no matter how ambitious we are with mitigation, we're not going to see much outcome in terms of making the temperature different. We can't stop all CO2 emissions tomorrow, and a lot of inertia is built into the system, not only as a result of the physics of the way the climate system works, but as a result of the lifetime of the infrastructure we've got. But this is also an era of climate responsibility in the sense that decisions that are made now and changes in the trajectory play a critical role in determining how much warming there is throughout the rest of the century, the period after mid-century, which you can think of as more or less a period of climate options. And what I really want to do for the next part is talk about what those climate options are. But just as a way to get started on it, let me replace the plumes with the map of the warming that's already occurred last century, and the map of projected warming from now until the end of the century for the world of continued high emissions and the world of ambitious mitigation. They are on the same color scale, and what you can see is that in the world of ambitious mitigation, lower left, the amount of warming that we'll see between now and the end of the century, more or less the same as the amount we've already seen, and clearly cause impacts, some serious ones that we need to be prepared for, but impacts that are fundamentally manageable. The world of continued high emissions at the lower right is dramatically different. You can see that, well, I guess in the back you can't, but I'll tell you, and you can trust me, that most land areas are more than 5C above current conditions, and the world is dramatically different. You know, in the ecological community, in the climate science community, there's been a lot of work in trying to figure out what the impacts might be in a world that's so dramatically different from the present. But my best estimate is that all bets are off in a world that's so different. I think that from a risk management perspective, what we really want to say is, do we have the tools to adapt to a world that's so different from the present? And in many cases, the answer is no. Here are a couple of specifics to help think about what that world might look like. This one's going to be totally unreasonable. So this is a map of the velocity of climate change. You can think about warming as sweeping isotherms of climate across the land surface at some pace. And then we can ask, is that pace faster or slower than the known migration rates of important groups of plants and animals? And the answer is that for major groups of plants and animals, rapid warming, a warming in a world of continued high emissions, is way faster than any kinds of migration rates we've seen for most major groups of plants and animals. On this group, faster than for everything except ungulates and some kinds of insects. But if you look at the warming in a world of ambitious mitigation, the velocity of climate change is actually comparable to the maximum migration rates of major groups of plants and animals, a clear indication that of the potential for adaptation in a world of ambitious mitigation that we don't see in a world of continued high emissions. And here's another example of projection of futures fisheries redistributions. Where the colors are red, there are major decreases in fisheries catch, and where they're blue, they're increases. For fisheries, we're really looking about a redistribution much more than a global increase or decrease. And warming essentially squeezes the major fisheries out of the equatorial areas. Areas like the Caribbean see a total collapse, through much of Southeast Asia, total collapse. So there's still fish in the ocean. Well, if we don't catch them, there's still fish in the ocean. But they're not where people are and where fishing industries are. And then finally, here's an example with food production in the world of the future, with based on more than 1,000 data sets, all the data sets that were available, going from the next few decades at the left-hand end, where you can see that the number of studies showing increases in the blue and the studies showing decreases in the brown are about the same height. But by the time you get to the end of the century, on the right-hand side, only about 20% of the studies show increases, 80% show yield decreases, and really frustratingly, almost 20% of the studies show yield decreases of 50% or more. A really clear indication that through the lens of the available information, risks increase dramatically moving forward. But we need a better way than just the few kinds of examples I've shown you to characterize this overall picture of risk moving forward. And what I want to do now is spend a little bit of time talking about a philosophy that we've used in the IPCC to integrate different kinds of information, quantitative information, qualitative information, expert judgment, to come up with an overall assessment of what the key risks are in different parts of the world and how they're changing through time. And we want to look at four periods, the present, this next few decades, this era of climate responsibility, when we're going to see the same temperature outcomes independent of the level of investment in mitigation, and then the end of the century, where we could be in a world of ambitious mitigation, it's marked here as 2C, or a world of continued high emissions. So this more or less provides a way to say, well, what are the avoided damages as a result of ambitious investment in mitigation, the difference between the 4C and the 2C risk. We'd also like to use the same framework in order to pull together different lines of evidence to say, what are the prospects for adaptation? And just nominally, you can think of our ability to deploy extra adaptation in the short term, indicative of an adaptation deficit, and the difference between our ability to adapt in a world of continued high emissions, the 4C world, and a world of ambitious mitigation, the 2C world, really indicates the failure of adaptation as an alternative to mitigation. We asked authors to look at every sector and every region and come up with the most important risks, and they came up with more than 100 risks that they identified as keys for particular regions and sectors. And here are a few of them. You can see that they concern food availability, human health, coastal risk, ecosystem issues. And there are a few commonalities that extend through all of these. The most important commonality from the perspective of the Ecological Society is that the prospects for adaptation are consistently much, much lower for natural systems than they are for human systems. Here's a zoom in on some of the key risks for North America. And the key risks that were highlighted by the authors who focused on this were wildfire, heat-related effects on human mortality, and urban floods. And the thing that you can see really strikingly is that the prospects for adaptation are less in the wildfire area than in the heat-related issues. And you can also see that the set of options for dealing with the human-related components are sort of more compelling, and they're more consistent with a sustainable development agenda than the options for addressing ecosystem impacts. Before leaving the topic of risks and going to the characterization of the solution space, I want to talk about a different element. And it's an element that I know resonates with the ecological community, but it's hard to get traction with governments. And it's the idea that values really matter. You know, there are lots of arguments that we should look at the costs of solving the climate problem, and we should look at the cost of the impacts and just come up with an economically optimal solution. But there are lots and lots of reasons that it's important to recognize that the assets that are at risk aren't necessarily well covered by traditional monetary measures. And I know that's clear to all of you. What we've done in the IPCC is try and create a number of baskets that can contain the different perspectives on thinking about risk and contain the different values that different individuals, different communities bring to the problem, and see if we can come up with a characterization of how risk is changing across each of these baskets. It's a useful way to think about the problem, and the five baskets are these. The first is unique and threatened systems, rare and endangered species, historically important sites, archaeological sites, one-off cultures, things that most people would agree are kind of beyond calculation with monetary value, even though they're very, very important. A second is extreme events. We know that most of the standard ways for calculating risk do a very bad job of dealing with extremes. The climate models do a very bad job of dealing with extremes. And so the assets at risk as a consequence of extremes, which we started out saying are really the key concern, are not well represented in standard economic models. The third one we call distribution of impacts, although I think about it as the unfairness component of climate change. We know that many of the most serious impacts will hit people and ecosystems that contributed the least and have the least ability to deal with them, and also contribute relatively little to the global aggregate GDP. What's the right way to think about the interests of those communities and those ecosystems? The fourth one is global aggregate impacts, and in many ways that's the easy one, the total global GDP, total availability of food, total availability of water. Those are things where it's relatively easy to come up with a number. It's hard to decide how to think about it. And then the fifth bar we call large-scale singular events, kind of the game changers or the major tipping points. What's the economic value, even if it's many centuries out, of a dramatic loss in biological diversity? What are the implications of committing the world to many meters of sea level rise? You know, there's been a lot of discussion recently about whether or not we have already passed the point of irreversible commitment to loss of the West Antarctic ice sheet, which contains about 5 meters of sea level equivalent. With Greenland, we know that the point of irreversible commitment to loss of the Greenland ice sheet with about 7 meters of sea level equivalent, somewhere between 1.5 and about 3C, and we're already almost to 1. How do you think about long-term commitments to these fundamental game changers? So in many ways, the way I think about these different ways of categorizing risk is, how do you think about the interests of nature versus people? How do you think about the interests of the poor versus the wealthy? And how do you think about the interests of the future versus the present? As the IPCC authors tried to assemble the information about risk in each of these categories, it's clear that risks are already increasing and have measurably increased in some, particularly in unique and threatened systems and extremes. It's also clear that they continue to increase as temperature increases. The difference that you see between a world of ambitious mitigation, more or less 2C of warming, is that all the risk levels are moderate to high at the end of the century, and a world of continued high emissions, something like 4 or 4.5 at the end of the century. We're looking at risks that are very high across all the reasons for concern. And essentially the threshold, and this figure had appeared in earlier IPCC reports without the purple. And what we realized is that a difference in our understanding is now the motivation for the purple is we know that there are a wide range of risks that can't be addressed with adaptation. And that's essentially the definition, the threshold. Well, I guess it looks like black. Anyhow, the threshold for transition to very high risk is the recognition that we have outstripped the prospects for dealing it with through adaptation. Tom Tolle's a wonderful climate communicator. I wish I could reach his level of succinctness. And this was a cartoon in the Washington Post the day after our most recent IPCC report. And essentially every other cartoon Tolle's has done, for those of you who can't read it, it says the new UN climate report in brief, and the grandmother is saying, your goose is cooked. He got it right almost every time he's addressed the problem. But he didn't exactly get it right now. And the reason I want to use this slide as we transition to talking about solutions is that the goose isn't totally cooked. We still have a window of opportunity for making sure that we can solve this problem, but it's a relatively brief window. Let me transition us to thinking about that here. What do we need to do to solve the climate problem? Here's a picture of a world of continued high emissions where at the end of the century we're still looking at something like 100 billion tons per year of CO2 emissions. It's a warming of around 4C, atmospheric CO2 concentration of around 1,000 parts per million. If we want to limit warming to 2 or 3, we need to be looking at emissions that go to zero by the end of the century. In many ways, this is a really intimidating number, but it's also a really empowering number for the following reason. You know, we've in the past have thought about dealing with climate change as finding a way to decrease emissions of heat-trapping gases, but that's no longer the issue. What we know the issue is now is that we need to find a way to bring emissions of heat-trapping gases all the way to zero. That's true whether the long-term goal is 2C, 3C, or even 4C. No matter what we do, we need to find a way to bring emissions to zero. Here's a way to understand that in a little bit simpler manner. This is a plot of long-term commitment to temperature rise versus cumulative CO2 emissions. It's essentially linear, and then all you need to know is that it's a linear relationship. You release 3,000 billion tons of CO2 to the atmosphere, you get 2C of warming. You release 5,000 billion tons, you get about 3 to 3.5C, and you release 7,000 billion tons, and you get about 4C. If you want to stabilize at any temperature, you have to eliminate CO2 emissions after that. The reason people didn't recognize this early on is that the CO2 is gradually taken up by the oceans after it's released by the atmosphere, and at the level of CO2 we have now, long term, about 80% of the CO2 partitions in the atmosphere. But as a result of the way the heat dynamics of the ocean work, the warming persists for much longer than the CO2. And the way to think about warming from CO2 emissions essentially lasts for 10,000 years. So that's the bad news. But the good news is that because the warming is permanent, and because we need to drive emissions to zero, it doesn't mean we're talking about a reallocation of emissions globally. Everybody who is going to be a part of the global community needs to find a way to have zero net emissions. Right now, we're already at the stage where this is a dialogue about whether or not India or Indonesia or Albania wants to be the last country ever to build a coal-fired power plant. So we're really talking about an energy transformation that's worldwide and not about a redistribution. Okay, just a few more minutes on what the solutions look like. There's a lot of frustration, as I told you earlier. Emissions of continue to increase. But there really is a lot of stuff that's happening, and I think in the environmental sciences community, we sometimes tend to be a little bit resistant to the evidence that a lot of the pieces of a solution are already in place. One piece of a solution that's already in place is that a very large fraction, more than two-thirds now, of global emissions are covered by some kind of an agreement with the INDCs that countries are offering for the Paris Convention later this year. That number should go up, but two-thirds global emissions are already covered by some kind of agreement, and what that means is that the dialogue now is about tightening the emissions agreements rather than finding ways to put new agreements in place. And then finally, as we transition to talking about the solution space, I think there's a really important new opportunity that's only recently come into focus. I think the historical paradigm for discussing climate change is that there were a series of very challenging trade-offs. We could either invest in economic development, or we could invest in mitigation, or we could invest in adaptation. I think what we're seeing increasingly is that there are a wide range of opportunities for investing in all three simultaneously, taking advantage of opportunities for win-win or win-win-win kinds of opportunities. And that's what I want to talk about for the last few minutes here. But at first, I'm going to let the video do it for a minute.
There are many ways we can reduce and manage the risks of climate change. There are low regrets options that reduce vulnerability and exposure, such as building safer homes, improving irrigation and drainage, and restoring ecosystems. There are also many tools available for anticipating impacts and reducing risks. Values, goals, and learning are important in responding to climate change. Reducing emissions of heat-trapping gases decreases the amount of climate change that will occur. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Working Group 2 Fifth Assessment Report assesses a wide variety of approaches for responding to the risks of climate change and building a more sustainable world.
Okay, we started out, this was a map of the problem space, but it also was a map of the solution space. Where are the opportunities for a solution? The good news is that they're really everywhere. I want to talk a little bit more about opportunities for reducing the amount of climate change that occurs as a result of climate change mitigation. And of course, the key in mitigation is that it allows us to stay in the space where adaptation can be effective. We know that there are lots of ways that we can make investments in reducing vulnerability and exposure. In fact, the core agenda of international sustainability and sustainable development is basically reducing vulnerability and exposure. And many of the actions to reduce vulnerability and exposure are actually the things that most effectively contribute to sustainable development. Lots of opportunities for win-wins there. Third, there are a whole bunch of things that can be done to address the challenge of risk directly. You know, we tend to think about addressing risk through insurance, but we can also do it through increasing risk perception, through increasing early warning systems, and through a range of strategies that that recognize and deal directly with the question of risk. Lots of things that can be done in terms of tweaking pathways of economic development, recognizing that there are diverse values and diverse objectives around the world, and recognizing that many of the pathways that are most compelling in terms of opportunities for individuals are also those that are the most resilient to changes in climate. We know that there are lots of investments in adaptation and mitigation that can yield co-benefits. Investments in energy efficiency are among the most obvious of those, and the investments that present right now the greatest set of opportunities. And there are lots of things that can be done to improve governance, and those can range all the way from different ways to think about education to different ways to think about coordination at the community, state, national, and international level. So lots and lots of ways that we can right now be taking advantage of opportunities for low regrets investments to find win-wins in the climate space. Let me finally turn just to speak to a couple of the opportunities in mitigation in particular. And I realize this one's probably too small to see, but basically, this is an estimate from IPCC Working Group 3, the Working Group on Mitigation, about investment flows that are needed for different technologies or in decreases in investment flows to be expected for the 19th century technologies. And in many ways, this is kind of a map of where the business opportunities are in the second half of the 21st century. In many ways, the building a climate-friendly energy system is the defining challenge of the 21st century, but it's also the defining economic opportunity of the 21st century. And based on this map, we need right now investment flows of more than $300 billion a year in energy efficiency, investment flows north of $100 billion a year in electricity generation, around $100 billion a year in renewables, order $50 billion a year in nuclear, and order $50 billion a year in power plants with carbon capture and storage. There are only two technologies on this whole figure that don't require an increase in investments, and that's extraction of fossil fuels and construction of power plants that don't have carbon capture and storage. So you can view this as saying, wow, we need to find a lot of resources to address the energy challenge. But I think you can also view it as there's tremendous opportunity here to transform the energy system in a way where the additional costs on top of those that would be required for the infrastructure that we know we already need are really, really modest. And that's really where I want to leave you today. We know a lot of things about the way climate's changing. We know that in many ways it is the defining challenge of the 21st century. But we also know that when understood, there's a challenge in understanding, managing, and reducing risks. There are ways forward. And I just want to leave you with one other thought from my idol, Tom Tolles. And it's about the pace of addressing the challenge. This cartoon says the year's 2060 and the search for a breakthrough technology to solve climate change continues. And in 2060, the only kind of solution that's relevant is a time machine that takes us back to 2010 when we should have done something about the problem. Thanks very much. Happy to take questions. And I think you have to shout, okay?
Can you comment on the expectations you have for the Paris meeting?
Yeah. So, the question is, what do I think is going to happen in Paris in December? As most of you know, the Conference of the Parties coming up in Paris in December is intended to produce the successor agreement to the Kyoto Protocol back from 1997, and it's based on something called the INDCs, Intended Nationally Determined Contributions. The UN Framework Convention is terrible about acronyms, but the basic idea is that it's transitioning toward a mode where rather than asserting that the world community will be able to force countries to do one thing or another, they're trying to encourage an environment of mutual ambition raising, more or less along the framework that I've discussed today. And there are lots of indications that ambitious INDCs have been forthcoming. People are probably aware that the U.S. has already submitted an INDC that commits to a reduction of 26 to 28% below 2005 by 2025. It's a big lift for the U.S. China has made a comparably big lift. And at least for me, I see this China-U.S. agreement as really breaking a logjam in the international negotiations. Copenhagen in 2009, It was clear that foot dragging by certain parties, especially the U.S., made it almost impossible to have a good agreement. And I think that the understanding that the U.S. is really committed to progress is really important. And in the U.S., I think that a reluctance to act aggressively would have been unavoidable unless China was also involved in a compelling way. There's still a lot to do. You know, the analysis of the INDCs says that if we just got the INDCs, it wouldn't make that much difference. And we're really in an environment now where what needs to happen is that steps here, steps there, allow countries to increase ambition, to learn from experience, to drive the costs of the key technologies down, and to have an increasing construction of a solution framework. I don't think we're going to see a comprehensive solution to the climate challenge in Paris, but I do think there's a real possibility of meaningful progress that will open a pathway to progressive improvements. Theory.
Yeah, well, I guess it's very kind of hypothetical because getting to that point. But so I think that it involves like making every single individual aware of it and like making a contribution. But you know, we're all, or a lot of us are ecologists here, and we all believe in this stuff and understand it. But how would you go about educating people who don't see climate change as that big of a deal and don't see the impact it's having on biodiversity?
Yeah, so the question is, it's easy to convince ecologists that we need to go to zero emissions, but for people who are skeptical about the science or don't see the impacts affecting them, how should the dialogue unfold? And I think that one frustrating feature of where we are in climate is that most countries deal with climate through their Ministry of Environment. Good. But the Ministry of Environment is typically the weakest ministry in each government and often has very little leverage on the national politics. We're seeing some really positive developments in the extent to which different countries are viewing climate as an issue that should be vested in the Ministry of the Economy or in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. I think it's incorrect, and it's clearly incorrect for individuals or countries to think, oh, this is just about biological diversity, it's just about food production. The impacts of climate change really affect everybody, and they affect every sector of every society. I think there are two things that are required for the conversation going forward. One is broadening this recognition that it's not just an environmental problem, it's a problem for everybody. And the second is the solution space, that there are opportunities for solving this that not only manage the climate problem, but open a wide range of compelling opportunities that let people around the world pursue their legitimate aspirations.
Chris, what's your take on methane? We hear a lot about it. People say it's, you know, such a potent greenhouse gas. We hear less about the fact that it goes away very quickly. In sort of the general context you've been talking here.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned that many of the biggest challenges are the greenhouse gas emissions that are associated with land practices, and methane is one of the biggest ones. That at least now the way we cultivate rice and the way we do animal agriculture really don't have a very good idea of ways that we can manage future methane emissions. And for countries that are big livestock producers, New Zealand, Argentina, they're terrified about ways to manage emissions. At the same time, they want to build their agriculture businesses. So the issue with methane, super complicated. I'll just say a couple of bright spots. One is that with the maturation of the fracking technologies, I think we now know that we don't need to have methane leaks associated with natural gas production. We still do, but we don't need to. The technology is available to address that. And there is some progress in addressing methane production from agriculture, but that's going to continue to be a big challenge moving forward. The fact that methane has a relatively short half-life, it doesn't help you as long as there are continued high releases of methane. So both methane and nitrous oxide are going to be big, big problems moving forward. They're associated with particular parts of the global economy, but they're the particular parts that provide food, and we need to have some kind of a way to address them. I didn't talk about it before, but one of the most effective ways to decrease methane emissions would be to somehow break the connection between increased economic growth and increased preference for meat-based diets. Yeah, go ahead. Say one more time, I just couldn't hear.
Overpopulation.
Oh. Right. You know, in the Kaya analysis, I showed that historical emissions over the last 40 years have been driven about 20% by changes in human population. And there have been a number of studies that say, well, what's the cheapest mitigation technology that's available now? And almost without question, the cheapest mitigation technology available today is meeting existing needs for family planning around the world. No question about that. On the other hand, when you look about at decades going forward, there are actually lots of positive developments in terms of demographic transitions resulting in decreased population growth and eventually in decreased population, at the same time that increases in consumption and economic activity are continuing very, very rapidly, so that by the middle of this century, most of the estimates are that we may be looking at a human population that's order 50% bigger than the current one. We could also be looking at a global economic activity that's fourfold bigger than the current. They both contribute to greenhouse gas emissions, and they both deserve to be addressed. They both can be addressed through aggressive creation of a non-emitting energy system. Blue shirt.
Just a quick question. It's kind of related to what we were saying. Is there any discussion in regards to the pace of efficiency versus the potential reduction in energy use in our economies? It's what, as you said, right? Like, we can go down on the numbers of people, but if every people consumes like four times the energy that, you know, we used to consume, what is that, you know?
I guess if I understand correctly, you're saying how do we think about the opportunities in energy efficiency and increasing GDP per unit of energy versus producing non-emitting energy? Yeah. Well, so let me say that at the global scale, there are very few discussions, and I think appropriately, about reducing the amount of energy we use. You know. In the U.S., we basically have a 10-kilowatt lifestyle. And around most of the world, people live with less than 100 watts of energy consumption. And there are lots of ways that we could do with less, but there is no doubt that legitimate aspirations for energy access will require an increase in energy availability in decades ahead. And I think that that's the strongest motivation for continued progress in non-emitting energy technology. Wide range of technologies that are available, and those can be deployed at scale with really acceptable environmental impacts. At the same time, there are lots and lots of opportunities for people in the rich world especially to be thoughtful about energy use, and I think that one of the real opportunities we have in the environmental sciences community is to set a template for compelling lifestyles that can be achieved at a decrease in total energy use. Design of cities, design of living and working environments, a design of what people want to consume.
Well, I want to thank you all. We should probably end it there. I want to thank you all for joining us.